we were entering a really competitive market, but believed in our ability, even though we were way undercapitalized compared to everybody else. Sold our first water bottle in March of 2016, and really the story since then has been pretty remarkable. At this point, we'll sell 14 or 15 million water bottles and tumblers this year, so over $200 million in annual revenue. The company's over 100 employees. It's been really remarkable to be a part of it.
My name is Matt Bros with Lockton, and I have been so fortunate in my life to be surrounded by some really awesome people. So I want to be able to get their stories out there so that we can all learn from them together. Welcome to the Excellence Culture. Welcome to the Excellence Culture. It's an exciting day here. It always is when I get to, you know, sit across a leader like I've got today. His name is Mike Beckham. He is the founder and owner of Simple Modern. If you're like me, I've got three people in my house. One is my wife and my two girls, that you cannot break them away from their Simple Modern cup. That's why I don't have one here, but I'm glad you brought one. But Mike, thank you so much for sitting down and just having a conversation.
Yeah, excited to talk with you, Matt. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, and it's been fun so far. Because we didn't know each other 30 minutes ago or an hour ago. And, you know, we've been talking about, you know, faith. We've been talking about leadership. We've been talking about, you know, your story. And so I'm really excited about what we have to talk about and just appreciate, you know, your time for sure. So I would love to kind of just get the conversation started by going way back to little Mike and just kind of hear about your upbringing a little bit, if you could.
Yeah, absolutely. So grew up in Oklahoma City, and one of the interesting things about me is both my parents were in the mental health profession. Growing up with parents that were in the line of work that they were, I think had a pretty big impact on me. When you think back about what are the things that I heard my parents say that stuck with me, you know, they probably said tens of thousands of things to me, but there are a few that stick in your mind. And one of them was that they explicitly told my brother and I, there are a lot of different things we could have done. We did not choose this line of work because it pays well, because it doesn't. We chose it because we felt like we could help the most people. And it's interesting. Enneagram is a you know, kind of a personality test. I think it's kind of been helpful for me. I'm an Enneagram 3, which means I tend to see the world in terms of accomplishment. And I was doing some reading about my personality type, and one of the things it was saying is that you tend to view the world in terms of accomplishment, but what accomplishment looks like, how you define accomplishment, is actually heavily influenced by the house that you grow up in. So I grew up in a home where accomplishment was really defined by helping people, which is, you know, such a gift, right? Mm. Like, that's such a healthy way of thinking about doing something meaningful with your life. And I think my parents being in that line of work and the way that they talked to me about it had a really big impact on me framing the dream for my life, how I wanted to use my life. I was always going to be driven. Mm-hmm. I think that's just kind of in my bones. But how I would funnel that, I don't think that was a given. I think that's on the kind of nature-nurture spectrum. It's much more on the nurture side. And so really fond memories of growing up. Grew up in with my younger brother, who's about 2.5 years younger than me.
Okay, gotcha. And rural part of Oklahoma?
No, Oklahoma City. So, you know, now Oklahoma City was not what it is today. Yeah. It's actually pretty interesting. I've been fortunate to be front row for a pretty remarkable transformation. If you look in the United States, it's probably had about as good a 20 or 25 year run as any city in the United States. It's been interesting to be in that environment growing up. But
it's one of my favorite cities.
Yeah, it's a great, you know, it's a great combination of, especially today, it's a great combination of fantastic people, hospitable, friendly, but then also you've got some of the amenities that would come with a more major city, you know, that we have an NBA team and some of the other things. Interestingly, this is just an aside, but what happened is years ago, decades ago, we had a project that a referendum to taxpayer fund a new arena. And at the time, there was no real reason Oklahoma City needed an arena. Like, nobody was banging down the door to come to Oklahoma City. But taxpayers bought into the vision, and we built an arena, and through a very unpredictable series of events, that led to us getting the Thunder and a number of other things. And people saw this. They saw, like, hey, if we invest in the city, like, if we really do believe in the vision, like, it's possible for us to create something bigger. And so I think they're on like Maps 5 now or whatever. They've had several different initiatives. They've continued to invest in the city. And every time they have, the city has just continued to thrive. So for me, it's been, you know, when you talk about being an entrepreneur, a lot of entrepreneurship is having vision of how the world can be different than it is today.
Yeah.
Right? If
that's
you can't envision a different world, then you're not going to like entrepreneurship much, because
yeah,
that's really all it is looking at the world and saying, how could it be better? How could it be different? And maybe to some extent, that comes from being in a physical location where I've seen that happen. Like, there have been posts on Twitter that have gone fairly viral where somebody's taken a picture of downtown 25 years ago and picture today and put them side by side. And you're like, wow, that doesn't even look like the same place. But it's just an illustration of when we put our mind to it, it's actually pretty amazing what humans are capable of building and capable of creating. And that's true whether you're building a city or you're building a company.
Yeah. Okay. So grew up in Oklahoma City. Did you play sports growing up?
Yeah. So played sports, basketball and track were the two main things that I did in high school. And so I really enjoyed it.
Point guard?
No, sadly, this is exactly why my basketball career was short-lived. I was a three. So, you know, like, there was a point in like eighth or ninth grade where I think they thought I was going to be really, really good. Yeah. And then I stopped growing.
Yeah.
And so the dream started to end. And then I had kind of the good fortune and misfortune of during the time that I was in high school, we were the number one team in the state. They have like an Oklahoma power rankings regardless of class, and we had the number one team in the state for almost two solid years of that. So I got a chance to play with some amazing players, and I very rarely saw the court as a result. But, you know, we were just discussing this. There were so many positive things that came from being heavily involved in sports. Learning to compete, learning to work on a team with people that are different than you, you know, think differently than you, that are skilled differently than you are, that come from a different background. Experiencing, well, I have this theory that sports teaches you a few things, and I know sports has been a big part of your journey. That one of the things it teaches you is it teaches you what it's like to be the worst player on a team, what it's like to be the best player on the team, you know, what it's like to be a good teammate, like what it's like to lose gracefully, what it's like to win gracefully. Like, all of these things are things that if you learn them, then they're invaluable as you go on into life. I don't know how much we teach those intentionally. Like, a lot of the youth sports and stuff, like, we focus on winning and we focus on development of skills. But to me, it was all the mentality stuff that I learned as a result of sports that I think has been the most useful for me.
Yeah. Well, now applying it as a parent is a full-time job for me right now. And this is kind of going off topic a little bit, but I'm interested in almost anything, your thoughts on anything right now, because I've got a lot of respect for you. But, you know, there's a coach on this volleyball team that my daughter is on, and there's a tendency that he would just, you know, bench players and not really say why. There's not a whole lot of why that I'm hearing. And I recently text him a message because my daughter had been benched for a long period of time and she normally plays the whole game. And I just said, you know, I want to know if you're going to tell her why so that she can improve. Because I just want to be dad. Like, I don't want to be coach. And I kind of expect that of a coach. You know, a coach to be able to come alongside and kind of say, you know, why I took this action. He doesn't agree for some reason. I'd be interested kind of like in your thoughts. Like, is it good for a kid just to kind of figure that out?
Is it good for a
coach to kind of tell them why?
It's a great question. You know, I think that one thing that is hard about being a parent, and I'm kind of going to extrapolate this even to leading employees in a company, is that helping them to get to where they're capable of getting is going to require hardship. And so that really works against some of our wiring, especially if you're an empathetic person. You know, with our kids, it's like, I want my kids to have better than me. You know, like, I'm hoping to translate my hard work into them having a better experience than me. And, you know, I don't want them to experience pain. I don't want them to experience difficulty. But what the research all says, it's pretty unanimous about this, is that that's actually great for them.
Yeah.
And because that prepares them for the real world.
Yeah.
That, you know, parenting is basically helping your kid to fail in non-fatal ways. Mm-hmm. You don't want them to fail in ways that create, you know, lasting damage, but you do want them to have to struggle and have to build the muscles that come from persevering through things. So, yeah, like, I mean, my initial reaction is like, man, you should tell somebody, right?
Yeah.
And you should help them get better. But what's interesting is, and you know, I don't know if the coach is doing this intentionally, but what's interesting is your daughter's being subjected to an experience, if you think about it, mm-hmm. where things aren't going the way she would want. And it's really ambiguous why. And that happens a ton in life, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, have you had that happen? I've had that happen a ton where it's like, why is stuff not working? You know, like, why is everything not going the way that I want it to go? And learning to have the inner resolve to, okay, I can't control it, and I don't necessarily know, but I'm going to refocus myself on what I can control, mm-hmm. and I'm going to do the best I can. And so, you know, like, whether or not that coach is intentionally doing that, you know, or there's some kind of, you know, method to their madness, interestingly, I think this experience probably will be really beneficial for your daughter.
Yeah.
And so this is the counterintuitive thing, I think, about development, is that development really requires wrestling, and it requires difficulty. And this is one of the reasons why the human brain and spirit is actually, it's pretty remarkable that we have the ability and the capacity to grow and develop through almost anything.
Yeah.
You know, we can take almost any situation, and it can be redemptive in that it makes a positive impact in our life. And probably the opposite's true. We can take any situation and we can make it not that thing. And so I think probably what I would say to your question is, as the parent, I think the coaching, like, the opportunity is to help coach them through, okay, this is a difficult situation, right? This doesn't make sense. You're not being told why. What are you going to do about it? How are you going to respond to that? And that, in some ways, that might actually be more applicable to life than somebody saying, hey, your serves aren't very good. You're not going to get to play till your serves better.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Kind of get to the heart of the matter.
Yeah,
more than
exactly.
That. Yeah.
Or learning the kind of more meta skill of just like difficulty for ambiguous reasons.
Yeah.
And I mean, like, I've felt this in entrepreneurship. Now, entrepreneurship, there's so much ambiguity. Mm-hmm. Like, I think that's probably one thing that cannot be overstated, is that you are just constantly in a state of questions that you don't know the answer to, and sometimes that you can't know the answer to. And okay, how do I, in a world where there's so many things I don't know and there is this ambiguity, how do I continue to move forward? How do I continue to have a bias to action? That's the skill set that really is kind of foundational to building things. So happy to talk about that more, but
cool.
I think it's a great, my hope is that we don't get so industrialized with our kids' activities that we lose the opportunity to do what they're intended to do, which is help them become, you know, successful adults and high functioning adults.
Yeah.
And I mean, you see the same things I do. The research out there recently about how kids are doing is not great.
Yeah.
And I think it's super interesting that we tend to view ourselves as like, we're kind of the apex of, you know, we have the most sophisticated thought ever. We have the best technology. Obviously, we're at the height of our thinking. And it's like, are we? Really? Like, if you look around and how people are doing, like, there's a lot of indications that there's some things that that maybe we're not doing it the right way and that we could. So I try to be thoughtful about that. Instead of just assuming that, like, the way we're doing things is the right way, like, there's some indications that maybe we've, you know, with our technology and with the way that we're doing things, that we have lost our way a little bit, and that 20 years from now, they're going to be like, man, that was silly that, you know, they did it that way.
Yeah, I wonder if it's kids distracted or parents distracted or both.
Yeah, right? I mean, I feel like everybody's more distracted.
Yeah,
it's such a, for us, when did you get your first cell phone?
I was in high school, my senior year in high school.
Okay, I didn't get one until college. Okay. So that makes you and I unique in that basically the most formative years of our life happened without this particular technology. Yeah. And I have come to, like, I think technically I'm a millennial, but I don't have a lot of millennial characteristics. There's a little grouping of people that kind of fits in the age range that you or I are in. And I think the reason why is that basically you're more defined about how and when technology entered your life in a big way, especially the smartphone, than anything else in terms of the way that you see and experience the world. But you and I know what it was like before cell phones were just integrated into everything, and before we were getting 5 hours of screen time a day, and it was pretty different. Yeah. And there are certainly some things that we've lost. One of them is our attention spans have certainly gone way down.
Yeah.
I'm reminded of that every day, that okay, being the person I want to be is going to require me pushing back on the way that technology is kind of constantly saying, "Hey, look at me, look at me, look at this," and you know, I mean, especially as a CEO, like the number of emails, the number of notifications, it's immense. So the discipline of not allowing myself to be distracted is something I'm working on. I don't know how I'm doing, but I think, to your point, I think it's
huge. You've got to be intentional with it, though.
Sure.
Naturally, I think we're going to go the direction that probably society is going. And, you know, so, yeah, that's good. Well, let's get back to your story a little bit. College years, you went to the University of Oklahoma. I went to the University of Texas.
Right. So we are mortal enemies.
Yes, but I think there's a respect. Like,
oh, yeah.
It's different
for sure.
With Aggies, you know.
Same with OSU.
Yeah.
I mean, sorry for everybody who went to an agriculture school.
Yeah.
This is the snobbery of the main state university speaking.
Yeah, but we got the Red River rivalry. But all that to say, I'd love to kind of hear about who you were going to college, maybe what you were focused on at the time.
So, as I mentioned, my frame for the world was accomplishment.
Yeah.
I'd grown up going to church, but, you know, like, I don't think that was the major kind of worldview I took. It was like, I'm going to go to OU. I was going on a full ride, and I'm going to get a 4.0, and I'm going to win a bunch of awards, and I'm going to fill out my resume, and that's where meaning and purpose are going to be found.
Mm-hmm.
And joined a fraternity. I probably looked like a typical fraternity guy in every way, except I had better grades. And really, ironically, I was very successful in what I was setting out to do. In terms of on paper, it looked fantastic.
Yeah.
And that continued for about 2 years. And after about 2 years, I just kind of internally, emotionally hit a wall where I realized I'm really looking for something that I am never going to find.
Yeah.
The way I'm going after it. And a very difficult period, I think, for me. I started to become open to the idea that there was meaning and purpose somewhere else. There were a couple guys that their faith was important to them that were a part of my fraternity that I had really respected. And it led to me starting to look into faith. And I bought a Bible. I'd never read any of the Bible, basically. I'd read like the first two pages of Genesis, maybe, you know, and then it was like, okay, I don't get it. So I bought a Bible, didn't tell anybody, you know, because I'm a fraternity guy. But I just started reading in the New Testament. And I would say over a course of about 6 months had my life really changed. Mm. Culminated, I was in school for 5 years. I tell people that, you know, OU was going to pay for 5 years, so I was going to take all 5 years. My wife got 2 degrees in 5 years. I got one, so she kind of lapped me. but if you took those 5 years and you cut it right down the middle, that's when I would say that I had a major change in my life, that I became a Christian and total change to my worldview, and really an overnight change to my behavior and a lot of where I was putting my focus. Like, a lot of things just kind of changed all of a sudden. And so, as a result, I had these radically different halves of college, where the first one was all about trying to find meaning and purpose through accomplishment, and the second one was believing that actually my meaning and purpose had already been achieved through somebody else's accomplishment, and that wasn't going to be the thing that made me lovable or, you know, worth people's attention, and freed me up to be a very different person. So, at this point, I'm 44. I've really kind of lived, I would say, two lives. Like, There's kind of my life up until about halfway through college, and then my life since then, and in a lot of ways, very different people. But once I became a Christian, it made me kind of rethink through a lot of things about what I wanted to do with my life, how I wanted to use my skills, my career, things like that. And right around that time, I discovered finance. And as I mentioned, I was at OU on a full ride. School always come fairly easily to me. But when I went into my first intro to finance class, it clicked in a way that almost nothing ever had. It was just like, oh, okay, this is what I was kind of made to do. I'd always been pretty good at math and quantitative and intuitive. And so it just, it made sense on so many levels. And pretty quickly I thought, okay, well, clearly I'm going to go into finance. I'm going to, you know, go work on Wall Street or something, and then maybe I'll be able to give, you know, and that'll be a way that I can express some of my values is through giving. And that was really, I think, my plan. Met my wife shortly after this period, who's had a massive impact on my life. We've been married
in college, though.
Yeah, met her in college. Met her a couple years after, or a couple weeks after becoming a Christian. So she wouldn't have liked me much if I'd met her like a few weeks earlier. I got lucky at the timing of when I met my wife. And honestly, one of the things, two things really attracted me to my wife. One was, just in terms of conversation and friendship, I had more connection with her than I'd ever had with another person. And then the other was she had a huge heart for giving. And I really was motivated by the idea of giving. And again, maybe some of this goes back to my relationship with my parents. But that really brought us together. There was a similar kind of dream for our lives and how we can make an impact on the world. And so that was where I was going into graduation. I thought I was going to go work in finance. We got married right after I graduated, and she had one more year. She was doing a BACMAC, a bachelor's and master's of accounting at OU. And so she had an additional year after we got married and was going to need to be around campus. So there not a lot of high finance jobs in, you know, Norman, Oklahoma. And I had this opportunity. Somebody gave me an opportunity to stick around and work for 1 year working with college students in ministry. And so I took it. And I thought, I'll do this while my wife finishes up her degree. And then we're going to go to, you know, Dallas or someplace, New York. And she had done internships with KPMG and Ernst & Young. So she was on the kind of like, yeah. If my wife had gone into public accounting, she absolutely would have been like a partner type. You know, she was her own, a force of nature in her own right. And then a really funny thing happened. Like it just kind of all got blown up. I did a year of ministry, and to my surprise, I just loved it. I loved that I got to use all of my time basically talking to people and that making an impact in other people's lives. And so 1 year turned into two. I re-upped for another year, and she went into the working world. And then after 2 years of watching me do this, she said, I don't actually want to be an accountant. I want to do what you're doing. And we worked together for the next 7 years in full-time ministry. And that was pretty much my 20s. So by the time I got to 30, it was like, well, all right, I guess this is who I'm going to be. You know, I guess I'm going to be in full-time ministry. And there were some dreams that I had that would mean, you know, I wasn't going to chase after. But I think I felt comfortable in my skin. Mm-hmm. And then ironically, it was right at that point in time that things take a turn back towards business and entrepreneurship. Yeah. And I have a younger brother that I mentioned. He's 2.5 years younger than me. He had done some kind of solo entrepreneurship stuff that had gone pretty well, but he wanted to start a company. And he asked if I would help him on nights and weekends build a company. And I told him, sure. It ended up very much not being nights and weekends. This was like not a like 4-hour
week.
This
is not Simple Modern.
No, this is not Simple Modern. It was an internet auction website idea. He said, will you help me recruit some guys? Will you help me build this? And I thought, oh, this will be fun. You know, like ministry is so intangible. Like I can do some of this and have like, you know, like be dipping a toe in the business world. Yeah. And that business went from the very first day of that business was October 3rd of 2009. By Thanksgiving of 2010, so 13 months about, it went from founding to having its first $1 million revenue day. Mm. I'm the oldest person at the company. I'm 30. You know, like think like kind of you watch the movie The Social Network where it's like a bunch of kids that don't even know what they're doing. Like pretty much that's what was going on. And we didn't even realize how absurd it was, the level of success that the company was having. I'm basically working two full-time jobs at this point because I'm still doing the ministry stuff, and I'm doing, and I'm like leading an important function of this company. And then my wife and I get pregnant with our first, and it was like, okay, this is a crossroads. Like, can't do all these things. I'm riding like, you know, multiple horses at the same time, and I'm not going to be able to be the kind of father I want to be, the kind of husband I want to be if I'm doing all of this.
And was there a conviction that was going on too?
Yeah, you
like
know,
even toward your, it was Campus Crusade, right, that
yeah.
you were working for, like just wondering if you were stewarding that as well as you thought you could.
It was super awkward because in the past, like when I was on staff, like I was supported. There were people I raised, so this is an important okay. thing when we get into the giving. I literally had to raise my salary,
yeah.
and I struggled to raise mm-hmm. my salary. It was not easy. And so that's the way that I made my, you know, not impressive income my first few years. And we weren't focused on that. Like, this is another part of the story that's important to mention before we get into where we are today. My wife and I, during our most formative years, our first years of our marriage, we really had a dream for what our life would be about that just did not involve accumulating stuff
yeah.
and or accumulating status.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's been phenomenally important as we've gone into a period where the company has a lot more notoriety and acclaim, and there are a lot more resources that foundationally who we are, that really got formed in those first few years of marriage, has still been the kind of North Star for us
mm-hmm.
that has guided the way that we make decisions, the way that we treat people, the way that we spend our money. And I'm really thankful for that. I think when we got to this period that we're talking about where everything's happening all at once, it was just very awkward in that I had ownership in this new company, but I wasn't taking a salary, but I didn't feel comfortable raising a salary anymore because on paper yeah. I had this big net worth
mm.
and I have a really high motor. I don't know how much it comes across, but like very high drive. And so I'm working, you know, 80 something hours a week. And I think that I was kind of holding it all together, but I was very aware that once we became parents, that would no longer, yeah. like something okay. was going to give.
Yeah.
Like either I was not going to be there for my wife or my kids in some way. And so I was not going to be able to maintain this level of focus. So that's when I talked to a lot of people and made the decision ultimately to transition into the business world. And I do think that the primary, I made actually a list, I've still got it, it's a Word document, of all the reasons why I transitioned. Career transitions are really hard.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, I felt like I could make more impact with my life in the business world at that stage than I could even in the nonprofit ministry world. And so made the decision, this would have been about 2012, made the decision to transition full-time into the business world. And what I couldn't have known then is that it was, I probably knew it was going to be challenging. It was even more challenging than I thought it would be.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I was really way behind on some business skills. I hadn't been in the business world. And also some of the things about myself, I thought I was probably more mature than I was. So it's interesting when we think about maturity and where we're at as a person. Some of it is kind of what's innately inside of us, and then some of it is contextual to our situation. So I can be a very patient person in these particular situations because I'm used to them and I know how to manage yeah. them. But if you rattle me, if you take me out of that situation, all of a sudden I'm like, wait. Why am I so impatient? You know, like yeah. this is very different. And it's because, well, you just don't have any experience in that situation. You don't know how to manage yourself. And that's, I really experienced that
yeah.
I thought I was much more mature as a leader, much more mature spiritually, much more mature in terms of managing myself than I was, because what I'd really done is gotten very good at those things in a particular context. Full-time ministry,
yeah.
but I hadn't done that in the business world. Also, I was transitioning into a job where now my boss would be my younger brother, which is like all kinds of like that. That's its own challenge. And so I would say transitioning into the business world was like the start of some real personal growth. But
yeah.
going back to our volleyball example, it wasn't easy.
Yeah.
You know, it was very challenging, and I'm thankful for it, but it was not the easiest transition.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you're a very self-reflective person. Are there any intentional things that you do so that you are a self-reflective person, right? Like, whether that's just something that you have in your life, maybe it's community, maybe it's just something that you do personally to kind of survey yourself.
So I'm going to give you two that are really powerful.
Yeah.
And both of them are very uncomfortable, not surprisingly. Yeah. The first one is I ask the question why to myself a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I do a lot of deconstructing my thoughts and my actions and not settling for kind of the PR spin of why I did something and actually digging.
Yeah.
So I'm in a conversation, I make this comment that paints me in a certain positive light.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's easy to just gloss over that. Instead, I actually ask, why did I say that? Like, let's really dig. Like, why was it so important for me to put the spotlight on myself? Yeah. Why was I so consumed with appearing a certain way in front of that group of people? You know, why was I feeling insecure?
Yeah.
And here's the truth about asking yourself why questions. You ask yourself why questions enough, and you eventually want to stop, usually pretty quickly. And the reason is because you're going to get answers that you don't like.
Yeah.
And it is so much easier to live at the surface where we just don't examine.
Yeah.
We don't critically examine what we do and why we do it. We just kind of, we feel things, we act mostly impulsively, and making the decision that I'm going to be an intentional person and I'm going to try and have higher self-awareness and I'm willing to hear uncomfortable answers as I ask why questions. You know, it's interesting. One of the things that sets the Christian faith apart as a thought process is that it lays out this idea that why you do things is actually even more important than what you do.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas most people, it's like, you know, that's not, they're just like, what happened? All I care is what happened. Who won the game? You know, what did you do? Did you show up? But the idea that why you do things is more important is a pretty revolutionary kind of thought process. And the reason why I think it's true is because why you do things is the leading indicator, not what you did.
Yeah.
And it gives you insight into your thought processes and your heart motives and all of this stuff. And so the most challenging thing I could say to anybody listening to this is if you want to grow in self-awareness,
mm-hmm.
start asking yourself why you're doing the things that you're doing.
Yeah.
You know, and be ready for the fact that you're going to have answers that you do not like.
Yeah.
And
you're talking big picture, even down to the moments of life.
For sure. You know, like, why did I go grab the extra bag of Oreos?
Yeah.
Right? I was full. Why did I just go grab that? You know, what was that? What drove that? And why did I lose my temper right then when my son said that, right? That if you develop the muscle of being introspective and asking yourself why questions, you'll be amazed how much you learn about yourself. You'll be amazed how much you'll be amazed how much you see the flaws in yourself. And it's really easy, I guess, the truth
of those whys is going to create change in itself.
That's right.
You don't want to continue to tell yourself negative truths.
Well,
right?
And what I tell people is if you ask yourself why questions enough, eventually you will want to quit because it's that uncomfortable.
Yeah.
You know, and in some ways I have to do it in doses even still, because you just, if you do it every day all the time, you wear yourself out.
You'll be depressed.
Yeah, you'd be depressed.
Yeah.
And so I think it's something that has to be managed, but that's been really insightful. And here's the second thing. When I was younger, if somebody brought a piece of constructive feedback to me, my default was, you are wrong unless you prove yourself right. Right? Like the burden of proof is on your end, that this is false unless you prove it's true. And unfortunately for other people, I was also like a high school debate champion. So good luck, right? Like, you're coming at me, you better be ready to like prove that you're right. When I became a Christian, I realized if I really believe what I say I believe, then I'm more flawed than I'd like to believe. And so it reasons that when somebody brings me some critical feedback, that they're actually probably right. And that even if there's holes in it, on some level, what they're saying is true.
Yeah.
And I flipped it. I flipped it where I expected people to be wrong unless they prove themselves right, to I expected them to be right unless proven otherwise. And it completely transformed the way that I received feedback. That if you bring something to me, instead of immediately having my gloves up and being like, let's spar, let's see if you can prove that I'm wrong, instead being like, I'm sure Matt's right.
Yeah.
I'm sure Matt has something valid to say, and I want to have an approachability. I want to be the most receptive person to feedback that you've ever met.
Yeah.
And sometimes that means like it does. It feels like you're letting people, you know, punch you in the face a little bit because it's hard to hear that. But when you become a person that people feel like it's safe to share feedback, you know what happens? They give you feedback.
Yeah.
And what happens as a result of that is the blind spots in your life shrink. You start to become aware of things that you just didn't see before. And now the capacity to grow as a person is there.
Yeah.
Because you at least know. You know where the gaps are. You know where the ways that you need to get better are. And especially for me now, I'm a CEO. There's a lot of people I employ. There's a lot of people that have a kind of fiduciary interest in me liking them.
Yeah.
So one of the things that comes with that is people want to be likable. Yeah. Nobody wants the person who's in charge of their paycheck to dislike them or to be frustrated at them. But the downside of that for me is that people are going to be less likely to tell me if I hurt their feelings, if I offended them, if I came across as prideful or arrogant or uncaring or whatever. And so I have to try that much harder to make an environment where people feel comfortable, or I'm not going to get feedback and I'm going to become less self-aware over time, not more self-aware. I'm actually convinced this is what happens to a lot of CEOs, celebrities, athletes, is that they're just surrounded by people that want to be liked more than they care about helping that person develop and their character. And so, so those are the two. Ask yourself why and become receptive to feedback, even asking people. Like, this is another thing. Like, instead of being like, well, if somebody has something to say to me, then they'll say it. Instead, what if you asked all the time, hey, Matt, how can I grow? Yeah. How can I be better here?
Mm-hmm.
You've been around me. Mm-hmm. What are my weaknesses?
Yeah.
What are the blind spots? And when you can create that kind of environment, you're setting yourself up to have kind of the tools and the materials to become a different person over time. I'm convinced.
Well, I love how you really kind of talked about that at the beginning of being a Christian and some of the values. You know, it's humility really when it comes down to it. And I mean, and I think, you know, being a Christian naturally brings about a humility in somebody for sure. And so and that humility is probably one of the, you know, a great virtue of a great leader.
Yeah.
And so that's great.
It's interesting. This is just, you know, as an aside, but it's interesting that Christians have developed this reputation of being, you know, self-righteous, which is kind of like the opposite of what Christianity is about. And one of the ways that, you know, I heard somebody say this once, I thought it was so good, that, you know, if you were to say, Mike, you're such a hypocrite. You know, you say you're about all these things, but I see all these inconsistencies. I see all these ways that you don't actually live that out.
Yeah.
Internally, my natural reaction is to want to be like, no, I'm not. And let me give you all the reasons. But actually, if you think about what I believe, it's like, man, that sounds like me. I am pretty hypocritical.
Yeah,
yeah, you're absolutely right. That's actually why I believe what I believe.
Sure.
Like, you can't believe what I believe unless you believe that you are a huge hypocrite and that, you know, you're not able to actually live out your lofty ideals, and that's the entire reason that you need something outside of yourself. And so, interestingly, my faith has made me less attached to needing to be viewed as having it all together, or, you know, like, you know, that I never have inconsistencies or that I'm perfect or whatever. Like, that's actually the foundation. That's the start.
Yeah.
I had a professor once who was a finance professor, and I was talking to him when I was about to graduate, and he wanted to talk about me potentially going and getting a PhD. Anyway, in the conversation, I mentioned that I might go into full-time ministry, and he was like, oh, oh, you know, I mean, you could tell he was not a fan of this. He said, well, you know, I worked in emergency rooms for 10 years, and I have a very low view of humanity. So I don't think any of the Christianity stuff's for me. And I said, well, you know, it's really interesting because to become a Christian, that's the first thing you have to believe. Like, those are the table stakes. And so anyway, I think that that's one way that, well, you know, regardless of where you're coming from a faith perspective, I would say that having that kind of spirit of, I am deeply flawed.
Yeah.
And that I knowing that and embracing that is actually the beginning of becoming the person that I want to be, as opposed to trying to pretend that I do have it all together. And you in the corporate world, you're surrounded by this. You see this, like, this is a lot of the gap between the cultures that we want to have. I know that you want to talk about this stuff, and maybe this is the segue. The cultures that we want to have and we want to create, and what actually is oftentimes all this pretense, all this pretending.
Yeah.
And we all are people that have issues and are deeply flawed.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that we can't have really transformative culture. But we have to start by being honest with that, that, like, hey, we've all got issues, and we're not going to be able to apply this stuff perfectly. And I tell people this about our company all the time. We are a very different type of company. We are not a perfect company. We do not perfectly embody the things that we say we're about, but we are authentic. It is sincere. Like, we really are aiming at those things. And just because we imperfectly apply them and that there's inconsistency, I don't think that's damning. I think actually that that's exactly how it looks in any situation. Yeah. You're never going to be able to get it perfectly. But the question, the litmus test is it sincere and is it authentic? Mm. That's what you're looking for.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good. And I want to continue to the culture talk, but I do want to give a framework to people who are listening, because it's I think it's easy for people to know Stanley and Yeti.
Sure.
But you guys have a significant presence in the market.
Yeah.
And so I'd love to hear kind of, you know, let's go through your story to Simple Modern 2 and where your mindset was in creating, you know, the brand Simple Modern.
Yeah, so worked with my brother for several years and got very good at e-commerce. I would say it's just the high level. In 2015, I felt like I was at a point where I either wanted to go and start a company where kind of from day one, I could build a very unique type of mission and culture, or I maybe wanted to go back in the nonprofit world. There were a couple of guys that had worked with me, and I led several departments at this company with my brother, and they'd worked with me in the analytics department. And they just approached me one lunch and said, hey, our department has awesome culture. We love working with you. If there was ever an opportunity to start something together, we'd love to do it. And that's really how Simple Modern was born. I think Simple Modern was started out of a few ideas. People ask me all the time, like,
what year was this?
This would have been 2015.
Okay.
So people will ask me, like, how'd you get the idea for bottles? And it's interesting because the story of Simple Modern doesn't involve bottles, actually, at least the start. It really started with, what would it look like to build a really pretty different type of company? Different culture, different mission, where relationships were a big part of the focus. This was another thing I started to realize during my 30s as we had kids. It's like, man, if, you know, I don't naturally, like, work with you, or you're involved in my church or something, like, I just don't see you. I had a lot of friends. It's like, I see you once, maybe every 6 or 12 months. And so I started to think, like, man, what a life hack it would be if you really could build a company with people that you already wanted to spend time around. You know, we have to spend time around our coworkers. What if I wanted to spend time around all my coworkers? And so the convergence of a bunch of these ideas ended up being the thing that became Simple Modern. We knew we wanted exceptional culture. We wanted to have a focus on generosity. We knew we wanted to do something in e-commerce, and that was it.
Yeah.
No product, no anything else. And we looked at several different ideas. Some of them were really bad, and we're very lucky we didn't go down that path. But drinkware was one of the many things we looked at. And what we liked about there were a couple things we didn't like about the drinkware industry, or that scared us, and then there were some things that drew us to it. The thing that was scary is that, like, drinkware is a very uniquely fragmented category. It's hyper competitive. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like the pro sports of like consumer packaged goods categories. There's just, there are so many companies. Nobody owns more than 10% of the unit market share. And Yeti existed. Yeti was already a really big and successful brand. There were a whole bunch of companies that had a lot of capital that had been around for a long time, a very commoditized space. So the fundamental like technology, I guess if you'd use that word here, is vacuum insulation. It's out of patent. So nobody had the market mm-hmm. cornered on that. So it was really like we're walking into a market that's just insanely competitive with a lot of people that have a lot more money and a lot more experience and all the distribution. So that was intimidating. Mm-hmm. The flip side of that, though, was we knew there was a lot of demand. I mean, the amount, I don't know how many water bottles and tumblers get sold in this country every year, but I mean, it's billions, probably. It's, mm-hmm. it's a crazy number. And people are going to be drinking water for a long time. So it's a yeah. it's a pretty safe industry from that perspective. Like, it's still gonna, I would guess that you still have water bottles 200 years from now. I don't know what anything else will look like, but I bet people are still drinking water. And we looked at the industry, and we really had this perspective that it was about to go through a big change. That, like, I'll use this kind of analogy sometimes, that just like in the kind of fossil record, there'll be these kind of periods that they call punctuated equilibrium, where there seems to be like a whole bunch of development that happens real quick, and then there's not a lot for a long period of time, and then there's a whole lot of development. Similarly, the combination of vacuum insulation and stainless steel for cold drinks was kind of like happening around this time, and it led to this kind of Cambrian explosion of new brands and ideas. It was a disruptive period where there was an opportunity to kind of join the market. And as we looked at the market, we said, you know what, this is really going to be, it's going to be a fashion thing. It's going to be like a watch or a wallet or shoes, where, yeah, there's this functional side of it, but also there's this stylistic side of it. And that actually paired up really well with what we did with e-commerce. E-commerce really leverages the ability to have a lot of options. If you're selling to Walmart, they're like, here are three spots on the shelf. You know, we want, you're going to have a black water bottle and a white water bottle and a blue water bottle, and like, that's it. On Amazon, you can have 1,000 choices. And so we thought, hey, this industry is going to actually become a lot about color and variety and fashion, and that plus our ability to sell online, we can really make this work. It's also worth noting at this point, Yeti was still only making stainless steel. Like, they hadn't even started painting things yet. The other thing that we noticed was nobody was taking e-commerce as seriously as they should be, because all of the existing companies had made all of their money selling in physical retail. So they had built their entire structure around being great at physical retail, and the extent that they were doing e-commerce was just kind of a tack on top of that. Whereas we started with e-commerce, and then we eventually got to physical retail, but we really built a company around e-commerce. And we sold our first water bottle. Actually, the first product we sold wasn't a water bottle. It was like a tea infuser. And I would say it did just good enough that we were like, hey, I think we could do something here. Sold our first water bottle in March of 2016. Another thing worth mentioning, bootstrapped company. So $200,000, my life savings, basically $200,000. And tons of risk. You know, to be a successful entrepreneur, you basically have to be optimistic that borders on naive. So I not only did I have a lot of financial risk, but, you know, I was doing this with several close friendships. So it's like, if it doesn't work out, like, it's going to be, you know, there's going to be some challenges there. And we were entering a really competitive market, but believed in our ability, even though we were way undercapitalized compared to everybody else. Sold our first water bottle in March of 2016. And really, the story since then has been pretty remarkable. At this point, we'll sell 14 or 15 million water bottles and tumblers this year. So over $200 million in annual revenue. The company's over 100 employees. It's been really remarkable to be a part of it. And like you said, we're really fortunate to have a lot of very loyal customers. So would have never guessed where it would have all gone. But I'm not being modest. It was very humble beginnings. And we did not expect it to get to this scale. We just wanted to build something that, in its essence, in the culture and what it was about, was something worth building.
And so I think I've heard numbers of $250 million in revenue or so. Is that kind of where things are at?
We were right around 100 going into last year, and then last year we nearly doubled, and then this year we've grown even more. So we're going to be in the 200 and something range, which is at this point it's a big enterprise, you know. Yeah. Which even for me, I have this theory about organizations that you tend to think about an organization the way it was when you first joined it.
Yeah.
For whatever reason, it just kind of creates this frame that your mind goes back to, and you always tend to think about it like that's kind of the true version of this thing. So for me, I still tend to want to think of us as a startup. But you know, it's like we're not a startup. Like we're at this point, we're a, you know, even for a small company, we've gotten pretty big, and I'm trying to kind of wrap my mind around that new, you know, trying to mentally transition to where we are right now from where we've come.
Yeah. Well, I think it was, you know, I've been trying to remember when we were introduced to your product, and I believe it was during COVID. I think it was 2020, because I was still in a place where I don't know when Yeti got really popular, but I remember it was hard to get your hands on a Yeti, and it probably was before that. But then I started hearing about a little bit more affordable cup, and my wife said, I want to get this, and there was I think it took like a month to get it.
Yeah.
You know, really, really high demand time. And then I remember I got this cup in my hand. I'm like, this is pretty beautiful. Like, it's kind of weird that I'm calling a cup beautiful, but
I'll allow it. They're beautiful to me. They've changed my life. So for sure.
I bet. But I'm thinking about that time, and I'm thinking about being in your shoes and having a product that you can't necessarily fulfill the demand. Was that stressful? Was that something to celebrate? From a culture standpoint?
The COVID period was very stressful. Yeah. I mean, there's no way around it. The supply chain, it's funny when you start a company, what you're really signing up for and you don't realize at the time is that you are going to gain a ton of knowledge in a bunch of esoteric areas that you never expected.
Yeah.
And I knew nothing about supply chain when we started the company. And as a result of everything I had to learn during that period, I ended up being on like the front page of the Wall Street Journal talking about supply chain and doing a bunch of interviews, podcasts where I was kind of like the subject matter expert. And that was very much by the happenstance of COVID and just how broken things got, and having to be on the front lines of that and figuring out when the physical world starts to break down, like how do we continue to get our product to people? We were growing and our market was growing, and at the same time the ability to get stuff was more limited than ever before. One of the stories that I'll tell people when they ask about COVID, I knew COVID was going to be a thing. Wuhan was only about 75 miles from our major manufacturing facility in China. And so we were aware of COVID, I would say, early January. And by early February, I'm telling the team, like, hey, this is going to get here. It's a virus. It's going to be disruptive. We're probably going to have work from home for a couple of weeks. Be prepared. So I was not caught off guard at all when it happened. You know, there was like the really famous Thunder game that they canceled right before tip-off. It is kind of crazy that Oklahoma City ended up playing a pretty pivotal like part in that story. And then Tom Hanks comes out and says he has COVID within 30 minutes. And then it's just like everything kind of shuts down within, you know, 24, 48 hours. But, you know, we go to work remote because we had a plan in place. And the first, you know, we're doing Zoom meetings in the morning. And the first couple of Zoom meetings, I'm like, hey, guys, We knew that this was probably going to happen. We're prepared. We're in great shape. You know, I'm feeling confident. About 3 weeks into COVID, Target came to us. Our two customers at this point were Target and Amazon. Target came to us and said, listen, we can't buy anything else from you indefinitely because all of our capacity has to go to essential goods, you know, masks, hand sanitizer, this kind of stuff. We'll let you know when we can order again. That's basically what they said, which it's like, well, that's not great, you know?
Yeah.
Our other biggest customer was Amazon. And Amazon was getting just inundated with demand, kind of like you're saying. And so Amazon decides that instead of everything being at Prime, which they can't keep up with, they're going to go through and take 90% of the catalog and change it from two-day delivery to 1 to 2 months.
Yeah.
And they're going to basically play kingmaker and decide what are the 10% of products that we're still going to deliver in a timely fashion. And so we woke up one day and it was like, you know, I don't know, 60-70% of our products.
So it wasn't about your warehouse.
This one was about there. I mean, yeah, sometimes it was you had the product, but there was another kink in the system somewhere else. So anyway, in this particular example, we woke up and like, you know, 30% of our products were still going to get to people in 2 days, and demand flew through the roof. And 70% of our product, it was 1 to 2 months, and demand went down. And it was really like, okay, now I'm scared. Like, it was one of the first times where I was like, okay, maybe we aren't going to make it through this because this is so disruptive. You know, like, the stuff that is selling, we don't have nearly enough. A bunch of our stuff that we thought was going to sell is not selling. And, you know, what's going to happen? And unfortunately, I don't think that period lasted very long. It was 2 or 3 weeks before it became clear, like, okay, everything's going to be all right. But it was difficult. It was difficult to have a company that was really successful. And I felt like we had just kind of gotten to the point where we were, the early years of building a company are so unstable, and they're harrowing. Yeah. It's kind of like having a newborn. You just feel like it could die at any moment if you took your eye off of it. And we had just kind of exited that period, and then COVID hits, and it felt like we were going right back into that period. So, you know, I think that was probably the most challenging thing, is that one way or another, for the first 6 or 7 years of the company, we were constantly dealing with feeling like we didn't have enough inventory, or where we weren't positioned the way that we wanted to be. And COVID was an extension of that. And really, it's been in the last, 12 to 18 months that we've started to really feel like we fully have our feet under. And some of this is just growth. We had, I mean, it, just to put it in a frame of reference, when you run an inventory business, the way you grow is you buy what you think you're going to be able to sell. So if you sold $10 million this year, you've got to buy twice as much inventory if you want to hit $20 million next year. You've got to kind of bet on yourself. And the growing of the company was, I mean, if you can imagine going from zero to 200 million, the growth of the company was basically like over and over and over again, pushing all the chips in and saying, okay, now we have to take all the profit, all the capital, and put it all in inventory to be able to fund the growth.
Are you thinking about your people, of growing your people at the same time as the inventory?
Absolutely. Yeah. And at the same time, we had a company commitment to, we were going to give 10% of profits away, which was excruciatingly painful when we did it, because of the fact that we needed every dollar we could get. I've heard this said before, and I think it's really helpful, that a lot of companies have like a mission, vision, value statement. How do you know if the values are really values?
Yeah.
You know, it's not if they're on the wall. It's not if they're on the mission statement. It's if you can point to and tell stories of times when it really cost you to hold those things up. And so COVID was one example of this, but I could probably point to several over the course of the company. Like, one of our values is generosity. And there were many times where it was very painful to actually lean into that, because we really could have used that money in some other ways. As I mentioned, we were kind of habitually undercapitalized due to our growth rate and the industry we were in. But at the same time, it had this kind of catalyzing effect on, we're really about this, you know? And it helped us to recruit people that were really excited about that idea. I think probably at least half of our team are people that have a background in the nonprofit world, but felt like the business world is where they were supposed to be. So very excited about a company that would do things differently and would be committed to giving. But it's required a lot of sacrifice to actually live that out.
So, you know, it sounds like obviously COVID was a challenging time.
Yeah.
I know, after talking to you so far and seeing just what the reputation that Simple Modern has, is that culture is a very important piece of what you guys focus on. And so I would love to hear your thoughts around even how, you know, having this product that is it's a risky business to be in, right?
Sure.
I mean, you're highly invested and you're just every day hoping that they sell.
Yeah.
But at the same time, having such, it seems like such a safe culture To be at. So I'd love to kind of get in your head a little bit on that.
Yeah. So one of the things I say to our team all the time, I'd say to anybody listening to this, you get the culture you earn. You get the culture you deserve. It starts with, are you intentional about defining what you're aiming for? And many, many times when you see weak culture, it's because it was just never prioritized. That it was like, okay, well, we got to hire 5 more people because the business needs are this, that, and the other. Who has these skills? Okay, go grab those people with no thought about what type of team are we trying to build? What type of environment are we really caring about? And when you lack clarity about what you're aiming for, people optimize for money.
Yeah.
This is basically like the lowest common denominator is just making money.
Yeah.
And when you have an organization that's optimized for making money, then culture is totally, I'm not going to say culture is always negative. I would just say like it's a total crapshoot of what kind of culture that you're going to get and the type of people that you're going to get.
It's a fleeting goal. There's so much out there.
So it's what you have to do is start with saying, okay, what type of environment are we trying to create? And what are we going to do to make sure that we get that? Starts with recruiting. And are you leading with this in terms of the applicants you look at, the criteria you use for hiring people, and you know, are you being upfront with people about, hey, here's the type of environment we're trying to create? Have you developed good questions and ways to establish whether or not those things are actively true in the person's life? So this is one of my biggest things. Our values are excellence, generosity, growth mindset, humility, collaboration. I have not said anything that really, I don't think anybody would hear that and say negative word. Everybody would say, those are all great things. But you know what? Those things all cost something, and most people aren't actually putting those things to practice in their life. What you want is you want to go get people where it's already true that they have a growth mindset in their life, that's already true that they're expressing generosity. You can't go and find somebody where generosity hasn't been a part of their life. It's just good as an idea, and then bring them into your culture and expect them to all of a sudden, you know, be able to really express generosity. So we really recruit based on personal references, and we really care about the track record of somebody leading up. I used to think about culture as culture is transformative to people. Sometimes it can be. Most of the times, it's not. Most people, sometimes, like there was a documentary on the Patriots where they talked about Aaron Hernandez and how he, you know, basically he came into what they thought was a really strong culture, but it wasn't strong enough. Like his upbringing and the friendships he had and the culture that he'd grown up in was stronger than that, and they weren't able to kind of transform him. So culture is a flywheel. It's an accelerant for people to be who they already want to be, ideally. So what you're not trying to do is say, we want to have a culture of excellence. Let's go get a bunch of people that haven't ever cared about excellence, but now that they're in our culture, they're going to suddenly care about excellence. They're going to be excellent. Instead, it's, I want to go recruit a bunch of people that are already so driven by the idea of personal excellence and that drive themselves. And I'm going to put them all together. And what that's going to create is it's going to create this really positive societal pressure that when I show up, the days that I do show up and I'm not particularly motivated to be excellent, I'm surrounded by people that are. And it helps me to go ahead and be the person that I already want to be, even when I'm not my best self. And that some other days I show up and I'm that encouragement for somebody else. And that culture becomes this accelerant and this kind of bonding agent. This can be good, this can be bad, depending on what your culture is. But what you're trying to create is you're trying to create a lot of positive peer pressure to be like the group.
Yes.
And the key with culture is that it's just clearly defined. Where are the places where we want to have a monoculture of values? So like, we're about generosity. If you don't like the idea that some of your paycheck is going to be, you know, that some of the money that we make that could be going to your paycheck instead is going to charities, you're not going to like working here.
Yeah.
You know, and we want to have a monoculture of people that are excited about that. And then you want a diversity of backgrounds, approaches, thought processes, personality types, all these other things. So that's kind of the key to culture, is mixing diversity with consistency and uniformity around the key rallying cries, yeah. The key vision.
Purpose.
So, yeah, exactly. So one of the things that I say to people is, this is another really important point. Culture's like a garden. It only thrives if everybody picks the weeds, everybody waters the plants, everybody fertilizes the soil. Yeah. The way that you get this really positive environment is if every single person is owning it. And so what you were trying to do is you're trying to create a way where it's like, this isn't just the CEO, this isn't just senior management, this is everybody, this belongs to everyone. We all get to benefit from the garden when it's healthy, but we all have to have responsibility. I'm less than 1/100th, I'm less than 1% of the experiences people have in my organization at this point. So the idea that I can hold up culture by myself is just absurd.
Yeah.
One of the ways this has impacted me is that I'm more deliberate about how we define our values. I'll give a really quick example. If we say that we value generosity, it's easy to think, well, generosity is, you know, the company writes checks, we give away 10% of our profits. I know that Mike does philanthropy, so that's kind of, okay, that's how the company's generous. But if instead you say generosity is actually saying, whatever I have, I want to be open-handed with it for the benefit of other people, I want to share it with other people for the benefit of others. I don't, not just with my money, but with my time, my skills, my words, you know, my encouragement, whatever. I want to use it for the benefit of other people. Mm-hmm. Well, something pretty profound has happened. Now I've taken this from a value that feels like it's very top down to, well, everybody can be a leader if that's how you define generosity. Mm-hmm. And so defining generosity where, for, you know, for one of our customer support reps, it might be, man, the way that person uses their words to lift up people, they are the leader in the company in generosity in that particular way. Or man, that person who has three kids at home, they are a leader in sitting down with new moms, new parents, and sharing some of the things that they've learned and just giving away the things that they had to learn through years of raising kids. Like, they're gonna be the leader in that. And that you build a culture where you have many leaders, you have a multitude of leaders. It looks different based on how people are situated, but it's really powerful when you can kind of create that level of buy-in and that level of ownership. And the final thing I'll say on this point is, as organizations get bigger, there's a gravitational pull to revert to the mean. There's a gravity to just look like the surrounding, you know, kind of the surrounding population.
Yeah.
And what you're trying to do when you build a culture is, you know, I think Oklahoma's fine, but I don't want a culture that's just a proxy for Oklahoma. You know, like I want a special type of distinct culture. And I always was worried about the company growing because I felt like as we get bigger, the gravity is going to be towards just being like every other company and being like everyone else. What I didn't realize, and I realize now, and the encouragement I'd give everyone is, if you can build the kind of buy-in that we're talking about where it's corporately owned, where everybody owns the garden, what happens is culture gets stronger as you get bigger, not weaker. It goes the opposite way because everybody is taking a personal vested interest. And now it's not just Mike or Mike and seven leaders really trying to prioritize culture. Everybody is keeping an eye on it. Everybody is helping keep people in line. Everybody is help passing it down and teach it. So this is the way that we think about it. We're very intentional. We invest a lot of money and time in talking about it and developing it. I'll give one other simple example. Every time we're in office, we bring in food. Every single time. And the reason is not for the perk of free food. I mean, that's great, but that's not the reason. Mm-hmm. The reason is we create a context where when it gets to be, you know, 11:45 or whatever, and lunch gets there, everybody stops working. We have like a communal area where everybody goes in and has lunch together. And generally, lunches are not work focused. It is people just talking with each other, hearing about their weekends, hearing about like what activities they're doing, the trip that they've got coming up, what they've got going on, you know, at home. And that creates relationships. And this is the other part of strong culture that I think is so critical in such a technological age and a distracted age like we talked about. You have got to find ways to foster relationship. This is what bonds us together with others. This is the core of strong teams, is not when I'm just, you know, in the same building as a bunch of people that I don't know and I have no affinity for, but when I'm actually bonded to people, I know about their life, I know their kids' names, I know what's going on with them, I care about what's happening with them. There is some emotional connection. When you're able to create that, you're skiing downhill, especially in today's work world where attracting talent, retaining talent can be so difficult. And it's no wonder if people don't feel connected to their coworkers, then like it's, they're just, you know, it, like we said, and when you lack anything else, the lowest common denominator is money. And it's just like, well, where's going to pay me the most to show up? But when we start to be a part of a community and be connected to other people, be connected to a mission, it's very difficult for any company to come and pry us away from that, because that's where we belong. That's the thing that we are passionate about. That's the group of people that we want to be spending our time with. So we're really intentional about that as well, trying to create real relational connectedness among our people.
Yeah, and I love that you just said that it starts at recruiting and making sure there's the alignment with the vision that you guys are going. And I bet that is a pretty cool lunchroom.
Yeah. Well, sometime I'll have you come up and you'll see it.
That would be awesome. That would be awesome. I would love to just kind of conclude this conversation. I want to just talk to you about everything under the sun, right? But we can't do that right now. Maybe some other time we can. But I'd love to kind of hear, you know, maybe a little bit of a future glimpse of what, you know, is coming up for Simple Modern.
Well, we continue to grow. We're expanding internationally. I think we're continuing to work on how do we position ourselves in the market, and the companies continue to thrive. I think internally I'm thinking a lot about developing more leaders, you know, like increasingly making the company less dependent upon me and led by many people. And our giving is really ramping up, which is very exciting. Our giving budget this last year was $3.3 million. It may be, you know, it may be quite a bit more this coming year. So that's been really exciting. And then I think for me personally, it's thinking about how do I use the resources and the influence that comes from the company to make a positive impact on as many people's lives as I can. I've really been given a gift with the company and its success. And you know, if you talk to my kids, you'd know that I'm preaching this all the time to myself, to them. Like, this isn't primarily or exclusively for us. We want to use this for the benefit of other people. And I'm trying to work out how that looks. And so it's an exciting challenge.
Yeah. Well, I can't say other than just like, job well done, man.
Thanks, bro.
I mean, you've been given the gift of a motor, and you're using that motor really well. This has been more than I expected to be able to sit with you and just to kind of talk about your story. And I'm just going to continue to pray that it continues to go in a great direction. And so I appreciate the time, and welcome to the excellence culture.
Hey, thanks, Matt. Yep. Appreciate you having me on.
Thanks, man.